Hey, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to this week's message. My name's Aaron, and I'm on the staff team here at Eastlake. Everything we do around here depends on the generous donations of our local and online community, people just like you, who tune into these messages and see great benefit from living that idea that life is a gift and love is the point. So if you love what Eastlake is up to, we'd encourage you to contribute by going to eastlakecc.com. With that, let's jump into this week's message.
Today, we are continuing our series, Hugh Manifesto. I'm so excited you get to hear from our friend Jason Lewis. Please do a great job welcoming him.
All right. Well, hey, everyone. Really glad to be here today. Good to see you. If we've never met before, my name is Jason Lewis, and I've been a part of Eastlake for a good number of years now. And I currently work now as a firefighter in Bellevue, and every once in a while, they will bug me to come down and ramble for a little while. So excited to be here. And stoked to be continuing this series. If this is your first time, welcome. I think this is a really dope series. I mean, I've loved it so far. All the speakers have been great. And if you miss some weeks, honestly, go online, check them out, because some of them are really profound. And so today we're continuing Hugh Manifesto, where we've been looking in large part at the process, ideology, and method to becoming more human. And in that regard, more divinely human. We've been looking at the life of Jesus, and in particular, the Beatitudes. And those are basically these declarations on blessings and on the kingdom of God, on who we are to be, what we are to do, and the result of living this way. And today I am talking about mercy, and in particular, the Beatitude that states, "Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy." So, pretty straightforward. That's pretty much it. but it's kind of an obvious one. I think we know that mercy is a good thing, especially when it comes our way. And I think we all want mercy when we make an error. The tricky part, the hard business, is showing mercy to ourselves, and in particular, showing mercy to other people, especially those who have wronged us directly, betrayed us at the deepest levels. Even smeared our name and reputation, and even maybe in the worst cases have abused us in some profoundly awful ways. And mercy is kind of unique, because I think when we think of mercy, we might initially think of, like, forgiveness. But mercy is bigger than that, from what I can gather. It's a larger umbrella than mere forgiveness. I think if we took a poll in this room, we could talk about what it is to be forgiven. Like, you know, the guy steps on your shoe, or he cuts you off in traffic, or he skips you in line, or he says like an insult, and that can be forgiven. You can kind of just wipe the slate clean on your own. You know, it doesn't matter what that guy or, you know, gal's doing. You just kind of can move on and let it go. But I think we'd all, if we took a poll, say there are some things that have occurred in human history, in our own lives, and maybe in some of our own suffering, that we would describe as unforgivable. As those things which are so profound in their gravity and the way in which they have wounded us or impacted us, that mere forgiveness isn't enough. And I think the question, the far more important question to ask when those things happen, and maybe the more difficult thing to wrestle with, is there something that transcends forgiveness, something that extends to the unforgivable? And I would say it is for these circumstances where mercy may in fact be required. Now, I'm going to come back to that in a little bit, because at first I want to start to talk today about the process that, as best as I can see, enables us to be merciful not only to others, but firstly ourselves. And we talk about this a lot of these, like, so much of what we do here is about recognition that the ability of us to be healthy, to be aware of, I think we talk about it a lot, we sometimes call it like shadow work, or the, you know, the errors of our past, or the wounds that we carry, or the suffering that we're enduring, that so much of what we have to do to be able to live out these lovely and beautiful ideas is to also have that stuff internally, have a measure of self-love, have some mercy for ourselves, have some kindness and some understanding and some forgiveness and some patience. These things we kind of have to know to be able to extend. And if we don't know them innately, if we don't have them to give, because we aren't giving them to ourselves, then it becomes, I think, increasingly more difficult to offer it to the world at large. And I mentioned this maybe a few years back, if you attended back then, but I went to this place called the Hoffman Institute. And I went at a time in my life when I truly disliked who I was. I was deeply angry, impatient, explosive. I was extremely reactive, so much so that, you know, for lack of a better thing, a pin could drop and I would pretty much go off at the handle. I had made so many errors and so many mistakes and had kind of just bottled them up for years. And in bottling, which I think so much, especially in the West, is it's kind of preached to this idea of kind of, you know, just staying tough, staying concealed, holding things in. This really insidious process began where I started to believe and equate who I was with what I had done, what had happened to me, how I felt. I began to believe, really, that I was genuinely a bad person, someone who was unforgivable, and someone to be feared, and even at times to be loathed. And I'm not sure back then, maybe I wouldn't have articulated it that way, but I knew that I really, honestly, I kind of hated who I was. And any error, I don't know if any of you have had this, where any error you make kind of reaffirms the damaging and hurtful internal messaging that you already have. So whatever that may be for you, you make that mistake, and then it kind of says, see, this is who you are. You know, you do good for so long, then you make a mistake, and you're like, nope, that, remember, you're this guy, you're this kind of person. And long story short, through this process at Hoffman, I began to unwind what was ultimately at work within me and found down at the bottom of myself just a very simple lie that I kind of just held on to and operated from a long time, for a long time in my life. And it just was just that I wasn't good. And I think it probably started when I was really young, maybe like 6 or 7. And you start to kind of maybe, depending on who you are, consistently disappoint the people in your life you love and respect or feel that their love is withheld from you relative to how well you behave or operate, do things, and you begin to internalize this sensation that like, I can never get it right. I'm just not good. I guess I'm just not a good person. And I lived my life that way for a very long time. When I was married, when I began raising my son, when I would attempt a new job or take on a new challenge, the foundation of my sense of self, my ego, right, that thing that navigates the world, it operated from this position, and that I was ultimately and innately bad. And so I did what I think is a rational response, right? You strive. That's what human beings do. It's something we're really good at. We strive really hard. And if you don't know me, I love to fight. I grew up boxing and wrestling all through junior high and high school. I love conflict and love things when they get shitty hard. And so it became a part of who I thought I was. You know what I mean? I'm just this bad guy, but the one thing that I'm really good at is I could just like really suffer. And I can like really just keep pushing. And I thought that, like, you know, I jumped to church and serving and reading the right books and thinking the right thoughts and doing all the right actions and living this really morally pious life. And it was all in this hope, not really so much to like oppress or judge other people as much as it was to hopefully one day maybe work myself into the moral positive, that one day I would feel from trying so hard to be good that one day I'd just feel good, that I would all of a sudden like wake up one day and go like, oh, and today, because of this series of deeds in this right order at this particular intensity, you are now a good guy. And the tragic part is that it never came. Still hasn't come. No matter how much I tried or how valiant my efforts, I kept thinking that an external voice, whether that was God or an authority figure or someone I greatly revered or thought a better human than myself, would affirm in me my own goodness, and then I would just mystically believe that more than I've believed anything, and then I'd feel really good. I mean, it's silly to think about, but that is exactly what I was doing. And the reason it doesn't work and didn't work and hasn't occurred is because things like self-love and mercy for our imperfections and errors and love of who we are just doesn't come from an external source. We must align our perspective with that of Christ, that to be fully human is to recognize, it's the awakening, it's less of a set of actions, it's the awakening to the truth that you are you're just loved, that we are made of love, and that simply being is enough. And, you know, a while back, a long time ago, but my granny is 94, so the wisest person I ever met. And I just made like some really bad mistakes, you know, early in my life. And I remember I called my granny and I just was like, you know, I just don't feel like a really good person. I don't feel like I'm doing anything right. And, you know, and my granny just said, you know, I've known you for a long time and I know you've been carrying this for a really long time. And it's gotten really heavy. And she just says in this, she's from the South, she just has this way of saying things. And she said, you know, you just need to go on and quit on that now. And just having someone say, like, just quit that. Just quit defining yourself by your worst moments. Quit saying who you are is this awful person. Even when you make errors, you need to quit on this system that you're abiding in. Because it's not helping you. It's not making you more lovely. It's not enabling you to be more merciful, more loving, more kind to the people in your life that you cherish so much. And I don't know if that's helpful for you, but I don't know what you're going through, but I would advise you, if you find that you're carrying this burden and that the sense of yourself is one that is dark and limited and flawed in an irredeemable way, that you need to quit on that. And you need to have mercy for those parts of yourself, and you need to write a new story. Because otherwise what happens is you turn into the Hulk. I don't know if you know the Hulk from like Marvel, right? Bruce Banner is like my favorite character of all time. I'm really fortunate my kid's favorite is the Hulk too. So we get to nerd out on that. But the thing is I always loved Bruce Banner, right? Because he's like just freakishly smart, really intelligent, and like, I mean, he's like unlimited strong. If you know anything about the, you know, Marvel Universe, let me break it down. The Hulk is strength is only rivaled by his anger, and as a result, his strength is unlimited. So nobody really knows. So there's like moments where he can't pick up a tank, and then someone hits him, and all of a sudden he can pick up the tank like a feather. It's just everything is tied to how distraught he is inside, and from that comes this hideous strength, like C.S. Lewis says, this really unbelievable power that lives inside his wounding and his rage. And the problem with Bruce, the really sad and tragic thing about the Hulk, is that Bruce is tortured and things happen in his life, and because he's unable to have mercy for his flaws and have mercy for the fact that he carries within him this monster, right? Like we all do. That it gets triggered and then the monster rears its head, and that monster doesn't talk and it doesn't communicate. It just rages and it destroys everything, even the things it loves, even when it tries, even when it strives. It destroys things because it doesn't have the capacity to live in love, so it can't operate lovingly. It lives in fear, sadness, and like, you know, rage. So basically that's all that it can really offer. And as a result, you know, Bruce vanishes. Like he will literally vanish for years at a time and the Hulk will run the show. And all of a sudden he'll pop out of it. And he only pops out of it, of course, when the woman he loves, the only person in the world who sees him when he is the monster and has mercy for him, all of a sudden he turns back into Bruce again. And the truth is, I think we all know, the Hulk is not who Bruce is. Bruce is Bruce. Bruce is the one. The Hulk is the lie. It's the figment, right? It's the fake portion of himself that, if we're not careful, lives in all of us, and if we give it rein and reason, it will live our life for us. You will be triggered because of some wounding or some area that you can't have grace or mercy for, and out of that pain and out of that suffering and fear, you will allow that reactive, angry, Hulk-like monster that we all carry to lead your life, walk in your relationships, walk in your job, walk in your friendships, the way you raise your children, and everything you do. And so it becomes incredibly important that we find a way to look at those things with soft eyes. The way my son, who's 3 years old, it's his greatest mercy to me. And I don't know if any of you have kids, but if you're a parent, you know this. You don't know that much. You know some things for sure, right? You can't have cookies every day and stuff like that. And like, you know, you got to take a shower and like, you know, wipe after you use the toilet. Like basic stuff, you got that covered. But when it comes to like the larger existential questions in life, like we don't always know, and yet we're just guiding this infinitely valuable human being into being an adult. It's a profoundly reckless plan by God, for sure. But the idea is that on top of it, when you have them, the way they look at you is like, it's okay. Like, I love you, and you're my dad, and we'll wrestle, and we'll talk, and you're going to blow it sometimes, and I'm still just going to love you. And those eyes of mercy on my imperfections are the awareness. It reminds me of, like, oh, that's who you are. That's what you should be. And you're going to have to quit on that, that anger and that monster. You're going to have to let that go, because the truth is that it makes you really strong. It can make you really strong. It can get you really far in life, and it's really scary to abandon. It's really scary to, because you've lived your life so long in pain or so long with this burden, that to then walk a new road and go, I no longer operate from that now. It's really challenging to do, and I understand why some people will hold on to their burdens or their traumas or their griefs for a long time, because it's who they've known they are to be, and to be something new, you feel like you might lose who you are. But if you want love and you want peace and you want beauty, then it's going to be critical you find a way to have mercy for those things.
Everyone, excuse the interruption for a quick minute. My name is Kristen. I'm one of the team members here at Eastlake, and we're so glad that you're joining us today on the podcast. It's been so encouraging for us to hear stories from people all over the country and the world who are listening to these messages and resonating with this idea that we just keep saying over and over again, which is life is a gift and love is the point, and that we are all committed to being a beneficial presence in our own community. So thanks for joining us. I hope that that's resonating with you. It's just really fun for us. So wanted to also say thank you to those of you who contribute. This place, all of these things that we do are happening because of people who make consistent, even just small consistent gifts. It helps us plan. It helps us know that there are really people behind us who want this thing to continue. So thank you to those of you who do that. If you haven't had a chance to give yet, I would encourage you to maybe think about doing that if you find this beneficial in your own life. To make a contribution, it's really easy. You can go to eastlakecc.com, and there's a donate button there with all the info. So thanks so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the message.
So hopefully we have an understanding of the importance and the need for us to find and have mercy for ourselves. That when we truly know mercy, we are significantly more equipped to offer it to other people. And through this process of having mercy on ourselves, we find space to bestow it upon another. Now, as for having mercy on other people, this is a much trickier game because you're used to your own messiness. You know your own flaws. I don't want to deal with a dude who had a crap commute, so now he's going to take a poop in my cornflakes because his morning was bad. You know, I don't care. I don't care why you're sad. I don't care why you're whatever. I don't want to have mercy for your flaws. And especially when you talk about big things, you know, horrible, grievous acts that are tremendously damaging to human life, the human spirit, to the well-being and safety of other people. Yeah, I certainly am not innately a person that wants to show mercy to the people who've hurt me, and especially those who have hurt the people I love. And I'm not a lover by nature necessarily. Like, there are some people who just have these really lovely, big, fat, juicy hearts. And if you have that, God bless you. I didn't get that card, right? So, but even from a purely rational place, even from a logical notion, I'm aware that if I'm asking and what I know I need to move on, to progress, to develop, to be more loving to the people that matter to me and in the world, if I'm asking for unwarranted mercy, then I'm going to have to find a way to offer that to others if I expect it to come to me. And still bigger than that, I think, is my true hope for people in the world and the larger world and the world that I would like my son to live in. And I don't know, like, if you've paid attention, this idea of mercy is just like dead in the water right now in the kind of, like, you know, public discourse, whether that's politically, where if you're like on this team, death to you and all you know, or if you think this thing, you know, economically, if you have different religious or spiritual ideas, you know, you're a cancer. It's just, it's so volatile. I mean, even Paul Allen this week, me and my buddy were talking about this, like, I would consider myself a more progressive-minded person. But, like, he died, and there were, like, articles that were like, Paul Allen didn't do enough. I mean, he gave away billions of dollars to people in need, but, like, he could have given more. And it just was, like, such a standard of perfection that I was like, is there, like, one, you don't know the dude. You don't know what he's ultimately going through. And so as a result, you make these assessments on why they do things. The next thing you know, he's held to a standard of piety that none of us could really meet. And then the beautiful part that was that dude. I mean, I didn't know the guy. I don't know if he's really beautiful. But I mean, even the money that he gave away, it just gets so tainted because now it's in the light of what he didn't do. If we're always going to be compared to the measure of what we didn't do, humans can't live to a perfect law. We know this. This is what Christ declares all the time. It's not capable of it. So this system of not having mercy for people, of rolling people into all these categories, is hugely damaging to any sort of connection, any sort of unity. I was in Fire Academy not too long ago, and my buddy Waldhauser, he's from Montana, and I'm a city kid, and like we were from two totally different walks of life, and we couldn't be better friends. And I'm sitting there one day, and this was like during the time when like they were trying to figure out if they were going to drill in the Dakotas. And it was obviously a huge fever pitch because Native American lands, and they're going to damage them and desecrate them, and yet the oil companies are like, we need the oil, et cetera. And everyone in my class is like, you know, at the time was like, you know, Bootram, he's the devil. And when Waldo found out, that's what we call him, he was like really excited. And everybody uncorked on this guy. They're just like, you don't care about the planet. You're clearly a selfish guy. And then all the other crap, right? Like, you're probably a racist and a bum. It was just bad. And I was like, all I did was I stopped and I remember I just looked at him and I go, why don't you just tell me why you're excited about it? And Waldo goes, well, my brothers, they work in the coal industry, or they worked in the coal industry in Montana, but then when Obama passed the Clean Air Act, their mine was shut down and 10,000 workers lost their jobs. That included, you know, my brothers. And so they were on unemployment for a year. They recently got hired by Conoco and they were shipped out to the Dakotas to help build the new rigs out there. And so when it got shut down, again, they couldn't work and they got little kids and stuff. So finding out that they're gonna be cleared to drill just, you know, means my brothers are gonna be able to eat and have jobs. And I was like, it's like super normal. It's like a super normal thing to be excited about. You know, like you have a family, you want them to be okay. Yeah, it's like not weird. It's not crazy at all. I think we all of a sudden, you were like, oh yeah, that's like a really healthy, normal thing. And Waldo is no more against the environment than anyone. And he's no more wanting to desecrate Native American lands than anybody, but he is caught in the space where he loves his family and he wants them to be okay. And if that's the line of work they were able to obtain, then you could understand why he'd feel that way. But because there's no mercy, because nobody is curious anymore, nobody slows down, we're way too busy, we can't ask questions, so we don't know why a person may do a thing or think a thing. And so no matter what we do, or no matter how we do it, we just say what a person is, who they are, how much they matter, and what their reputation is, and we harm them and label them in ways in which they can't uniquely recover from. And I don't know if this has ever happened to you. It's happened to me. It's one of the most painful things for someone to say what you are, and you're like, I'm not all that. There's more parts to who I am. You know, I have made some mistakes, and maybe every idea I have is not a good one, dude, but I'm not all darkness. I'm not all bad. But when you put me in that place, you know, all I'm going to do is either freak out on you and turn into the Hulk, or I'm going to shut down and no longer be who and what I am. It's like what George Bush always says, and it's one of his best quotes, is basically that we love to judge people, and we evaluate people by their worst moment, and we judge and evaluate ourselves by our best intentions. And that is the true cancer of engaging with other people who are different than you, who have made mistakes, is that we never look at them with these soft, compassionate eyes to say, is it a possibility that I may have operated similarly? Is it a possibility that I could understand that, see that, and have mercy for that? But because we sit in these chairs of piety, we look down with these long gazes, like an angry father, with just sheer disappointment, as if we're so pure and so righteous. Because I believe we're living in this era where we have assassinated myth, we've ridiculed wonder and mystery, and hedged toward pure rationale, confirmation bias, and selective outrage. And as a result, we have lost many beautiful ideas. We aren't stronger, we're not kinder, and we certainly aren't wiser for having done so. We are more informed, and we are more connected, and more real, per se. But if we bind to this idea that humanity and divinity are irrevocably tied, or one, or united, or however you think about that, then this baby bathwater mentality about concepts like mercy, unconditional love, and self-sacrifice, they must again be elevated to the seats they once held, and to dethrone these impostors of power and piety and self-righteousness and moral compromise. See, sometimes when my kid is, he's just like me, he's a total spaz, but he like, he will just drive me crazy. And I'm literally just like, boy, I just want to throw you over the mountains. Like, it's just, he's a nut, right? And when that happens, it becomes very challenging for me to operate with mercy toward him. I start to judge his actions. I start to label them as bad. And so I'm triggered. So now the monster is winning. And now I'm not loving him. I'm not operating from a place of love. And as a result, I'm just not a good dad. And so what I do, one of the things I do now, is when I feel that, I take a deep breath and I just pretend he's the last boy who will ever be. He's the last living boy on this earth. And it's not, right, capital T true. But the thing is that the second that I shift my perspective into that place, then it becomes immediately apparent to me how much I do not care that he says the exact right thing, does the exact right thing, has the right attitude, or even that he obeys me. It becomes immensely important that he knows how precious he is, how much he is loved, how inseparable from that love he is, how worthy and how beautiful he truly is. Now, I don't know many people in here that know the Bible. I don't really know it that great. But I do love the story of the prodigal son. It's my favorite parable. It's totally brilliant. And I'm just going to give you a quick rundown on it. But basically, it's like this. There's a dude, he's got three boys, and this dude is chipped out. Big old mansion, anything you could think of. One of his boys is just a real dickhead, and he's just like, you know what? Just give me my money that you owe me when you die now, right? This kid's like, and he takes the money and he bails on Pops and the whole family and he spends it on Betty's and playing Xbox and like drinking, you know, 40s of molten ice, just like chilling, not doing anything meaningful till he blows the whole wad and then rolls back up to Pops. And he starts, because the whole thing is he starts to realize like, dude, I've totally done something that's like unforgivable, right? Like you would never go to your mom and dad and be like, hey man, look, you're 60, you only got a couple decades left. Why don't you just ship me what you owe me when you die, right? You can imagine how horrible that would be. But the point is this dude does this, and so then what happens is when it doesn't go good, then he's thinking, like, this is an unforgivable act. It's not like I can go to someone at the bar and be like, you know when you ask your dad sometimes if he'd just give you the money when he dies? Yeah, that didn't work out good for me. And someone's like, totally. It's like, no, nobody can relate. So he's alone. So he's got to go back to his dad now. And what he's aware is that I've done something unforgivable. So what I'm worthy of if we live in a purely just system is I'm just worthy of slavery. I'm worthy of suffering. I'm not worthy of love. I'm certainly not worthy of mercy. And so he goes back to his father with a humble heart to say, like, dude, I'll just like literally scrub dishes, man. Like I'll do your landscaping. I'll scoop the dog poop. Like I'll do every lame job there is. Just like don't let me starve, you know? And the story says that like his dad sees him a long way off. I always love that. That sees him a long way off before the boy even sees him. And he just runs to him. And he's like, hey, Pop. And he starts to apologize. And dad's like, zip it. And he's like, dude, we're having a feast. Fire the music up. We're kicking it. My son's back. All's well. Don't even worry about it. Just forget about it. You're in. You're mine. You're with me. And has complete and total mercy and love for the son. And it's the story that I think we all, when we hear it at some level, we're like, oh, that sounds good. That sounds nice. Like, you know, I've done some things that if that was how I was treated on the way back in, that would have been really good. And that's why it's so lovely, because that is what God is like. That what we are owed isn't simple punishment sometimes. But sometimes we're owed slavery. Sometimes we're owed suffering. Maybe even sometimes we're owed death, if we want to play the justice game. And so I think when we think about that, we can even see where notions of hell come from, because we know we've done something. We've participated in something that's unforgivable, and we're aware that how does this get set right? Somebody has to pay, and it's probably me, because I'm the one that made the grievance, right? But thankfully, and not even thankfully, just beautifully, the ground of being, this eternal love hasn't forgotten mystery or hope or beauty or love or mercy. It knows that we know what justice is. We probably know it a little too well if you're to judge our incarceration rates. It also knows that we are still a long ways off of knowing the capacity and power of love and mercy, this ability to show mercy for the most heinous, darkest, and awful things we've done or do, or tragically have had happen to us, that this is still lost to us in large part. And this is where I'm going to lose some people. Because this is the question that I asked earlier. Is there something that transcends mere forgiveness? Is there something capable of finding a way forward for these types of things? And I'm talking the things you're thinking of. Like, because when you talk about mercy, it's not like forgiveness. It's like you're thinking, again, you're thinking the lynching tree. You're thinking the executioner's block. You're thinking the firing squad. Those moments where the king has every right and you're like, mercy, please, mercy. There's nothing I can ever do to pay it back, to warrant it. Is there something that can hold this weight? And I can't answer this for you because it is a matter of perspective. Because some of us have been through some things and seen some things. I'm not going to sit up here and arrogantly tell you that those things should have mercy upon them. I am no judge, right? I do know this. I need mercy, and I certainly hope there is. And I would like to try to convince you, maybe not convince you, but at least place the seed of this idea that this beatitude isn't nonsense, that the idea that blessed are the merciful because they will be shown mercy, that it's not naively optimistic or a broken scheme, that it's actually the height of beauty and the height of recognition of human value. So we're going to do something super weird. What you please, for just a moment, I'm going to have you close your eyes, because I want you to vision something with me. And then after that, we're going to open them and I'm going to play a video clip for you. But it's from a movie called The Pianist. And it's about a young Jewish man who's a concert pianist. And the Holocaust comes and his family is taken from him and they're placed in internment camps. Many of them are killed. And he ends up alone and he's running. And I want you to envision what it'd be like to know that there is no mercy for you left on this earth, that everybody you know and love is gone, they've been taken from you. And that your life in the realm of justice in this land, it does not count. And so there is no appeal to mercy. There's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can say. There's nothing you can offer that will enable them to treat you differently. And so you run as best you know how, and you hide in a house, and you're starving to death. You haven't eaten in a long time and you're incredibly weak. And you think you might be safe here for another couple weeks before you have to move again, but when you come downstairs, standing in your kitchen, is an SS officer, is a no-joke person that's job is to exterminate people like you. And he asks you before he's going to kill you what you did in your earlier life. And you tell him you were a pianist. And he asks you to sit down and play a song. And then this happens. I always love that clip, and I think it's important to note that after that, the German soldier decides to not only let him live, but he brings him food and tries to help him survive, and in fact does for the duration of the war. And then when he's set free and he's walking home, he sees the German soldier in cages now, because now the power is flipped, and now he will be the one who dies for which there will be no mercy. And he tries to plead the man's case to set him free, but he's not able to overcome it, and the man tragically is killed. But I think when we see that idea, blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy, what happened there? What happened to that officer? What occurred in his mind and heart upon seeing him play that made him change his mind? What engendered him to act with mercy? As best as I can see, it's the recognition of the very simple truth that humans are divine and beautiful. And like Brené Brown says, people are really hard to hate up close. So you move in. And he sees it and witnesses that and all of a sudden realizes, like, you can't kill him. that it doesn't really matter what the system is, it doesn't really matter what the just thing to do is. What matters is that mercy is what's required for someone like this, for everyone. I think, even the SS officer, God, that's a hard one to reconcile. But maybe that's how far mercy goes. You see, we show up here every Sunday. Let's be honest, not every Sunday. but we show up in the hopes of fixing the world, of bettering ourselves. And are we to do this as the group with the right ideas, the group with the most defensible or well-reasoned positions? Is this how human hearts are transformed? Or do we walk in mercy and love and faithfulness? Do we ask questions and seek understanding? Do we recognize that sometimes it's a mystery, and sometimes we need the ledger wiped? I remember when I was a boy with my mom, I did a lot of things wrong as a kid, and I would get in trouble a lot. And so I get punished and punished and punished, you know, like I just get sent to my room or things taken away or spanked or whatever. And some days I would be the worst kind of kid. And on those days, my mom would pick me up and put me in the car, and I thought I was going to get in trouble. I thought maybe I'd have to go like stay at my dad's or stay with my grandma. But she would drive me to Dairy Queen. And I can just vividly remember it, and she would just buy me an ice cream. And she just looked me in my face and go, "Just so you know, I love you no matter what, no matter what you do. If you never listen, if you never obey, if you never do the right thing, no matter what, I just love you always. And you're always good." And I think human beings need that, and I think that's why mercy is so critical. Because I think it communicates how much we count, how valuable we all are, despite the mistakes and the things we've done. And so I hope you understand what mercy is, how to have it, how to cultivate it for yourself, how to keep the green monster at bay. And I hope you allow the concept, I hope you allow yourself to have mercy toward others. And I hope you allow the concept of true undeserved mercy to work on you. Let it break your heart and anger you and perplex you. But recognize in the story I told and countless others you probably know or could find out in the world, note the power of mercy to change things, to break systems of power, to rearrange roles and reputations and sentences. And lastly, I hope in that silly little story about myself as a boy, we can see how we are still that kid, blowing it from time to time. And sometimes we need a little bit of mercy to remind us of how precious and loved we truly are. If you please stand with me. So may you this week be merciful to yourself and to other people. And may you know that when you are merciful, that it is likely what will be returned to you. Thank you for your time. Have a great week.